felt nice to be there, I can tell you. You know, it was exhausting and it was challenging. And again, that was everything I've done for the past 2 years. All the money I've spent, all the energies I've put, all the things I had to go through, it all comes down to that one moment. The run between Rainy Pass and Rome, with all going in that headwind windstorm, with a full moon, you could see the whole Alaska Range, all the mountains around you, you know, in the winter. It was not snowing, it was a ground storm, so it was just a mess, but you could see all the mountains around it and the dogs were on fire. That has absolutely been one of the highlights of my life. I'll never forget how thrilling and exciting that moment was.
Throughout season 2 of A Life of Dogs, we've explored some amazing stories from the Iditarod, the last great race on Earth. This incredible event always throws up its fair share of drama and chaos, none more so than the 2020 edition of the race, where a fierce snowstorm and the biggest pandemic for a century played havoc with competitors and organizers alike. Now, every musher's journey to the Iditarod is unique. To succeed, it takes a number of special qualities before you can even think about lining up with your team of sled dogs for that ceremonial start in Anchorage. You need persistence, you need skill, hard work, and dedication. It's a tough enough challenge for experienced mushers, particularly those who have grown up in Alaska with the race coursing through their veins. But how do you cope as a rookie musher who has traveled from a little farther afield, approximately 8,000 kilometers away, to be a part of this event? What sacrifices do you have to make to compete in a race as daunting as the Iditarod? For Fabio Berlusconi, a rookie musher making his debut in the 2020 Iditarod, his journey took him from his native Italy to the harsh terrain of Alaska. And as we know, the 2020 edition of the race was more treacherous than most. It would be a journey and a race that Fabio would never forget. In our final episode focusing on the Iditarod, and as a wrap-up to our second season, this is the story of Fabio Berlusconi's maiden Iditarod voyage, as told in his own words. From A Life of Dogs, I'm Jason Pergeson, and this is Where is the Finish Line?
Oh, well, I mean, it has been an interesting one, I can tell you that. It was my first one, and it's, yeah, it definitely good gave me a good idea of what it can be.
For many of the mushers in the Iditarod, indeed several of the ones we spoke to when we were in Alaska, they've grown up around this race. They understand it deeply, and they know the challenges that they will face. Even those mushers who didn't grow up in Alaska itself, but were born elsewhere in the United States, have formed a close connection to the Iditarod that inspired them to take part. So what exactly led Fabio from a small town in northern Italy to the greatest sled dog race on the planet?
Well, everything started basically in 2010. I took a cycling trip in northern Europe. I went from Rovaniemi in Finland to Nordkap, which is the northernmost point in Europe, by bike. And I just fell in love with Lapland and with the north. So I just went back home and basically quit my job and decided to try and find a job up there, anything outdoors. And I found this amazing job with the dogs just by chance. And it was nothing planned. So I just said, okay, let's just try this. Let's see how it goes for a few months. And lucky enough, I ended up at Mats Pettersson's kennel. And from there, I never left. So what was supposed to be just one season turned into 9 years straight. So the other very lucky thing is that Mats is one of the best long distance mushers in Europe. And starting in 2014, he has done 6 Iditarods in a row. So that's how I started to get to know the Iditarod and start traveling the first time to Alaska with his dogs and helping him out and working with his dogs. And then what really made me decide to start thinking about the Iditarod was 2018. I was there with Mats and his dogs, and I followed it the whole way through, you know, from from the drop bags and getting everything ready for the race and following him and being at the finish line. And I say, oh boy, I think, you know what? I think I can do this. I think I want to give it a shot and let's see how it goes. So from then, the last couple of years, it's been all about that. So I quit the job with Mats and looked for some team I could run my qualifiers with and the race in Alaska. And that's what I did. So I spent the last 2.5 winters basically in Willow, Alaska. And I ran my qualifiers with Jor Olsson's dogs. Jor is the 2018 Iditarod champion. So last winter, I ran my qualifiers with his dogs. And this year, I ran the Iditarod with Lingwood Fiddler's dogs.
The road for any musher to the Iditarod involves sacrifice and hard work, but particularly for someone who is a new entrant to the sport. And remember, actually running the race is just one of the aspects of the musher's work. There are countless hours of preparation that must be undertaken before the sled dog team is ready to hit the trail and run the race. As a rookie, what exactly did that road look like for Fabio in 2020?
Yeah, basically, you just have to rearrange all your life. Once you have that in mind, you just have to go for it. You just have to take all your money and all your efforts and put it into that thing. So I quit my everything. I have been living in Sweden for 7 years and I quit everything over there. I sold my car. And the bad thing is that I'm allowed to stay with my visa for 6 months in Alaska. So I can do a full season and do all the racing, but I'm not allowed to work. So basically in the last couple of years, I haven't been allowed to make any money. So, but again, once you start deciding that, you just have to go for it and do anything that needs. I knew it was going to be quite a big effort and a lot of energy and a lot of money to put into it. But, you know, it made my life way better. You know, once I had that goal in mind, I felt like I could do anything else. You know, just say, okay, whatever comes my way, I'll go over it. I got that in mind and I just went for it.
When did you start this season in Alaska?
I went to Alaska on October 16th, so just perfectly in time to start the real fall season. Because you know the dogs that I've been running this season have actually been working on a glacier down in Juneau doing summer tours, so they have never been stopping. But September, October, that's when you want to really start to get into the serious training program, you know. So yeah, October is a good time to start. So again, that's why it's perfect to have 6 months visa. I can be there October through end of March or April, which is exactly the racing season. That worked pretty great.
When you get there in October, you start working with that team and you're working with them every day, I'm assuming?
Well, yeah, we always run the dogs about 4 or 5 times a week. We always give them a couple of days of rest. And of course, when you start in October, you're going shorter distances. You're going maybe 10, 15 miles at what you start. And then you gradually go up and up every week. And all the training in the fall before we get enough snow is done with the ATVs. And it's raining. So the conditions are not the best. You know, it's not exactly the best trainings. But again, the dogs don't care. They need something to pull and you need to start getting on it. So it's tough, but it's part of the game. So then of course, every year is different. So sometimes you're lucky enough and you can be on the sleds. In November this year, I think we were on sleds for the second week in December, which is good enough. You know, some other years, we were not able to be on the sleds after Christmas in Alaska. When I was back in Europe, we were way more north. So we were always on the sled, maybe around the beginning or the middle of November. So that's a little bit easier and more enjoyable.
With his preparation complete, Fabio and his team of dogs were ready to tackle the 2020 Iditarod. As with any sport, in a race like the Iditarod, the weather conditions can play a huge part in the way mushers approach the event. Heavy snowfall, or even a distinct lack of it, can influence the strategy of mushers. And when they may elect to take their mandatory 24-hour layover. The timing and intensity of the snowfall can be difficult to predict, as Fabio explains.
It was just dumping. I mean, I think the 2 days before the race, we got 2 feet of fresh snow in Willow. I mean, even the day of the start, you know, we woke up in the morning, and it's not we could just, you know, take a coffee and take our time and go to the start. We were shoveling snow and using the snow blower and plowing snow. Otherwise, we would have never made it out of the kennel. You know, it's been a challenge, you know, and again, it's pros and cons, because we have all, you know, the last few years, especially in 2014, everybody's been waiting for snow and praying for snow. Because 2014 was the craziest year ever. There was actually no snow at all going over the Alaska range. So a lot of teams had some crazy accidents and had to scratch. And, you know, just you were just going with a sled on no snow going down the Delta Gorge. And that's scary enough. So same thing was 2015 and 17. And to avoid having the same, they had to move the start up to Fairbanks because there was no snow. So they just rerouted the whole race. And it only happened three times, 2003, 2015, and 17. So this year with a lot of snow, everybody was happy because it made things way much easier, but maybe we got a little more than we could have hoped for.
Careful what you wish for, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly what everybody was telling. Be careful what you ask for.
So what is it like to be there, you know, all this wind and snow and it's time. It's the start of the race. This was your first year, right? In the Iditarod, not first time mushing, obviously, but first Iditarod. I think the crowd, it seemed like the crowd there was maybe a little less, because of this year. So, can you sort of describe, you know, what that's like, what that feels like, what that looks like?
Well, the Saturday, the ceremonial start, it's just fun. You know, everybody's way is super relaxed and it's just enjoying. There's a lot of people around and everybody's drinking and handing you beers and all kinds of stuff. And everybody's just having a good time. And so there was a lot of people still downtown. I don't think that affected a lot. But the next day with all the snow we got in Willow, then I don't think there were as many people as there could have been. Because of all that, you know, people just couldn't make it there. And they were just suggesting people to stay home or take the bus there, not come with their own cars. They didn't even have time to plow the parking lots. So it's been quite wild. But yeah, you know, again, it was a very different situation and a very different mood from the Saturday to the Sunday. On Saturday, you're just not thinking about anything and you're just enjoying the ride. It's a short ride and it's a lot of fun. On Sunday, then that's when all the stress, all the fear, everything kicks in. Because I knew I was ready, and then I knew I had everything ready. I knew my dogs could make it. I knew I've been preparing for this for years, and I kind of had everything under control. But it's so normal. You're there and you're checking the checklist for your sled 20 times before starting, and you're so afraid that you're forgetting something. And what actually felt good is that I was there just before the start, and I had some friends who had done it before in the last few years, and they told me, well, don't worry. I mean, it was the same for everybody. You're not having a good time right now. I mean, it's normal. There's so much. You're just in a bubble. And then everybody's like, you'll see. Well, once you're out on the trail, you know, let the first checkpoint go, then you're going to get down in the mood and forget about everything. But it's a lot on your mind on the first day. I knew it was coming, but it was a lot. It was way more than I thought, actually.
Yeah, and you I think your bib number was 6, is that right?
Yep, I was.
Yeah, so you started toward the front, so you didn't. I guess you didn't have a lot of time to sit around and worry.
Well, in a way, that was a blessing, because if you were the last one to start, that would have meant 2 more hours of stressing time to come. So I would just like to get on it and go jump on that sled and get it over as soon as possible. You know, it's stupid to just stay there and keep stressing and checking again. And whatever is done, it's done, you know, so just get on that sled and get going, and then you'll figure it out eventually.
Support for A Life of Dogs is brought to you by Royal Canin. Royal Canin offers precise, effective nutrition for dogs based on size, age, breed, and to address specific needs. To learn more about Royal Canin, visit them on the web at royalcanin.com. And by Highland Canine Training, the industry leader in professional dog training solutions and premier canine education. Highland Canine Training offers turnkey solutions for everyone, from pet owners to law enforcement and military organizations. Learn more at highlandcanine.com.
As Fabio alluded to before the break, the ceremonial start is important, as mushers need to make sure they're fully prepared for the race ahead of them. Making a mistake at this stage will affect their team's performance for the remainder of the race. Once the ceremonial start is completed, the event restarts the following day. And this is where the race itself truly begins. For a rookie like Fabio, it was a true step into the unknown, as strategic decisions either turn into strokes of genius or lessons to be learned for future races.
So what was it like moving through those checkpoints and all that snow with this group of dogs? You had 14, I guess, you started with?
Yes, we started with 14 dogs, and it was good in a way to have such a slow trail in the beginning, because the first few runs, the first few checkpoints, you know, the dogs are so pumped up, you know, they're full in energy. So you basically are standing on the brakes for hundreds of miles until they start settling down in a normal pace. So having a lot of fresh snow helped a lot in that, you know, to just try not to go too fast. That's one of the very common rookie mistakes, you know, people are just going too fast. You know, dogs want to go and there's a lot of excitement in the air and you're just letting them go. I'm very good at that, so I've always been very conservative every time I've been running and racing, so I knew about that. So I was trying to hold back even with all the snow, but sure, the big snow helped a lot. But on the other hand, it made it tough for the dogs, you know. You were just plowing through inches and inches of fresh snow. And in a way, I think being upfront was also helpful in that sense. I was happy to have a lower number. It didn't really make a big difference. Sometimes you really want to be upfront so the trail doesn't get too destroyed and wrecked up by all the teams. And sometimes you want to be in the back, so sometimes it's actually breaking trail for you. You don't want to be the first. But in this situation, I was just happy to be the first and just be, you know, at least if you're in the front, you can hold back and you don't have to worry about, you know, whatever. If 5, 10, 20 mushers pass me on the way to the first checkpoint, I'm fine with that. There's no problem with it. And I'm doing it right, you know. As long as I had mushers passing me on the first couple of runs, I knew I was doing the right thing and taking it easy.
Yeah, I guess that's hard to do to some degree. When the dogs want to go, it's kind of hard, I guess, to hold them back.
Yeah, especially if you're a rookie and you have all this. I mean, around me, I had, between the mushers in front of me and the mushers right behind me, I had all people who have been in the top 10 of Iditarod plenty of times. So I was like, okay, if these guys are in front of me, I'm just doing the right thing. If I'm starting to pass them, then I'm doing something wrong. So that was also very helpful. You know, have some example and some something to look up on.
One of the biggest challenges for any musher in the Iditarod is the treacherous terrain of the Alaskan wilderness. Combined with the often brutal weather conditions, with temperatures feeling as cold as minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit, there's a reason why the Iditarod is revered as the pinnacle of the sport of mushing. As Fabio describes, these conditions can make for an absorbing and thrilling ride.
Well, the start is all on the river, so it's all flat until you get to Finger Lake. And once you are in Finger Lake, around mile 120, 110 from the start, then you start climbing up, and that's actually the big mountain range. Then you start crossing the Alaska range. So the next two runs is going to be up and then down. So you're slowly climbing up to the Rainy Pass, which is the highest point that you reach on the Alaska range, and then you're going down, which is actually sometimes even worse. You're going down the Dalzell Gorge, and that's where a lot of bad stuff happens, you know. And if you're going through some big crash, that's when it happens. So that's a big challenge. But again, the best thing about having a fresh team, you know, when I left Finger Lake with my dogs, it felt so good. My dogs were just on fire. It was finally a little colder. It was not snowing anymore. Temperatures got a little bit cooler. So the dogs just felt it and they were going. And even leaving Rainy Pass Lodge is actually just before the pass. So we knew it was going to be windy up there. So there was some thrill and excitement in the air for everybody. And we were going up the pass, and believe it or not, we were going uphill in a windstorm with wind gusts that were way stronger than 50 miles an hour. They were just slapping your face and pushing your sled off the trail, but the dogs were on fire. I was standing on the brake to keep the pace down while going uphill in a windstorm. And that was actually one of the highlights of my life. I cannot stress enough how exciting that was. It was borderline, you know, actually there was one team who actually didn't make it and had to turn around and go back to the checkpoint because it was almost scary, but all in all, it was just a big thrill. And again, that's the time when you really have to trust your leader. I mean, sometimes with all this wind gusts, I could not see more than two dogs in front of me. You have 14 dogs in front of you. And sometimes you don't see the trail, you don't see the trail markers, and you don't see your dogs. So that's when you really need some good leaders. You let them go and you're just standing there and letting them go. And that's an amazing feeling, you know, and they feel it. So the dogs were on fire and they felt my trust. And I was so excited to see how well they were performing. So it was such a good exchange in energy and it was absolutely amazing. Then we went through the pass and then we started climbing down the Dalzell Gorge. And again, that's where the big snow was actually very helpful because usually it's bare ground and some glare ice crossing the creek and you keep going back and forth and crossing the creek and there's open water. So having a lot of snow and very good temperatures actually leading up to the race, that made it for probably the smoothest going in years down the Dalzell Gorge. So that was a big relief when I remember when I got down, I got finally down on the river. I really felt so relieved. I was like, okay, that was a gorge and we made it alive. But actually then was another bigger challenge because all the ice down the river was just glare ice. So with a little bit of wind, you were just being pushed right and left. So, but it was just the last couple of miles on the river. Then we got to the checkpoint in Rome. And then, you know, the big part of the dangerous stretch was gone. Then there's also a lot of troubles can also happen on the next run, which is a 70 mile run between the Rome checkpoint and the Nicolai checkpoint, and you go through it's called the Farewell Burn and the Buffalo Chutes. And also there's hardly any snow. So this year conditions were even better than before. And again, in the past few years, there was very little snow and a lot of people went through, you know, they just wrecked their sleds and broke their legs. So over there, it was nice to have some snow and have some control over the dogs. So that all went smooth.
So you make it through these two mountain passes, and then what's next?
Well, what happened next is I stopped. It was a 70-mile run, so I was running, you know, a relaxed pace. I had mostly 2.5-year-old dogs, so that was exactly the plan, so taking it easy. So I broke that long run in two parts. So around halfway through, there's this place called the Buffalo Camps, and it's just some, you know, tore-down buildings from I don't know, the gold rush era, you know, some very old buildings. And you cannot really get in there, but it's a landmark. So that's roughly halfway through. So I just stopped there. And right next to me, I had camping with me, Gabe Dunham, another rookie, very good friend of mine, and Monica Zappa. And as soon as the sun went down, oh my God, the temperature dropped. I'm talking, okay, my thermometer is not accurate, but it went below 60 below, which I do not believe. No, it was probably around 50 below that. So we just camped there for a few hours. We just took some branches and made a fire and just, that's actually a very good moment. Those are the moments that you're going to remember. It was quite miserable. You're just sitting there waiting in the cold. And, but again, you made good memories. We just hung out together and that's when you make a bond with the other mushers and it's actually quite an enjoyable experience. And then as soon as we took off from there, we were just in a low spot, you know, you just climb up the hill, you climb up a little bit and the temperature went up 10, 20 degrees in just a few hundred yards. But so we were just camping in the coldest spot. But again, we're rookies, you know, and that was our landmark. So we just stopped there and whatever, and we stick to our plan. It was good enough. But yeah, and then all the run, all the way to Nicolai, that was around 40, 45 below. So it was cold, but that made me appreciate all the money I spent on my good gear over the years because that really paid off in that run. I got to the checkpoint and I was warm, no frostbite, dogs were happy. So yeah, that was good enough for me.
One of the biggest decisions for any musher prior to the Iditarod is deciding where to send drop bags, which contain the food that will be used for the dogs during the race. The drop bags are sent to checkpoints along the route, based on an assessment of potential trail conditions and anticipated progress. this can make or break the race for a musher.
Well, again, what most of the more experienced mushers have always been telling me is that once you're done with the dropbacks, you're halfway there, because it's such a huge job. You know, we're talking about, everybody's sending about 1,600 to 2,400 pounds of gear out to the checkpoints. Most of it, it's dog food and all different kinds of dog food. And you got to be ready for everything. You know, when it's cold, you're going to eat a lot of fat. So you really want some bacon or chicken skins or that kind of stuff. When it's warmer, dogs won't like the fat and they won't need the fat. And then you might need more like, you know, lean beef or just fish that's got way more water. So you got to have, for every checkpoint, you got to be ready for everything. You know, this year we were kind of expecting a warmer race because it was a late start. It started on the 8th of March. So 1 week later than last year, you know, it always starts on the first Saturday of March. But of course, this year it was on the 8th, on the 7th, and on the 8th, the real start. So you could kind of expect a little bit of a warmer race, but still you need to be ready with everything, especially with dog food. And luckily it was not my first time doing the dropbacks. You know, the last 2 years I've been preparing dropbacks for the other mushers I was training with. So I knew everything and I decided to do everything in good time. So even before Christmas, I had all my shopping done with all the gear I was gonna send over. And before the end of January, I basically had all the meat cut. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of pounds of meat. We got a 50 pound blocks and everything is cut in pieces that we call French fries. That's basically as big as a French fry, because that goes way faster when you have to thaw them out in the warm water or when you toss them at them for snacks. You know, if it's a big chunk and they are tired, they don't really feel like chewing it. So having a smaller, tinier piece, it makes it easier for them to chew and eat it. So everything has to be down to that size. And you need to have, again, 70 different types of food. We had two different types of main meat, two different types of dry food. We had bacon, we had beaver, we had fish, all kinds of stuff, and be ready for everything. And besides that, then you have all your stuff. You need to send all your food and all your drinks, because that's very important. You know, it's on a cold day and you're out for 24 hours, you use, you know, 1 gallon at least of liquids per day. So I actually sent more than 1 gallon per checkpoint and all kinds of stuff over there, orange juice, apple juice, iced tea, Capri Sun, anything that actually helps. And food is the same. You know, sometimes you are tired and you're just like dogs, you get a little bit picky. So I sent two different types of main meals and a whole bunch of snacks, you know, chocolate, candy, banana bread, beef jerky, you know, you name it, you know, all kinds of stuff. You always need to nibble on something just to keep your energy up and your brain working. So you got to have a lot of stuff.
As you can tell, to compete, never mind compete for victory, but just to compete in the Iditarod, takes so much preparation in advance of the event. There are so many things that mushers have to think about before the race. Yet, as with so many of life's greatest challenges, it's the unknown quantities that compose the biggest problems, the thing that you can't prepare for. In the 2020 Iditarod, the unknown quantity manifested itself in the form of a huge winter storm between two checkpoints, Koyuk and Elam. Koyuk is around 170 miles from the finish line in Nome, with Elam approximately 50 miles closer. The entire Iditarod course is over 1,000 miles long. The trail between Koyuk and Elam, 48 miles. So you might think, hey, no big deal. That's a small fraction of the race. Surely a little winter storm won't derail their progress. And you'd be thinking incorrectly. For some of the mushers in this race, at that moment, Nome could not have felt further away. Fabio picks up the story.
Well, Elam was quite... spent a lot of time there, a little bit more than I thought. But you know, if you want to talk about Elam, you need to start talking, you know, already in Unalakleet. You know, it was snowing like hell on our way to the checkpoint. We're talking 100 miles before that. And we got to the checkpoint and they started talking about this big storm approaching, and then we're going to be 4 feet of overflow on top of the ice because the wind would, you know, push all the water on top. And I was like, okay, let's have that in the back of our head. So I just left UNLCLIT, went to the checkpoint of Shaktulik, and over there talked to the natives and see if they had any fresh news about that. And yes, it was all confirmed. The storm was coming. So I didn't rest that long in Shaktulik, and I decided to go straight, because after Shaktulik, you're crossing the Northern Sound. You're on the sea ice for 40 miles all the way to Koyak. And you do not want to be stuck in overflow there or in a storm there. I mean, the ice can break at any time. And if you're just hit by a storm over there, there's just no landmark whatsoever. You're just out there in the middle of nowhere on the sea ice. So I wanted to just go ahead, get to Koyak. At least I knew that the big dangerous part of the Northern Sound was behind me. And that's what I did. And it played out very well. Because if I was 24 hours behind, just like what happened to the people doing the Adirondack Trail Invitational by bike, they were stopped in UNLCLIT because the ice just broke and there was overflow everywhere. So they were just not allowed to go anymore. There was no trail and the race was over. So I was very happy that I took that decision. And then we got to Koyak, and me and two other mushers, both rookies, Damon Raymaker and Grayson Bruton, and we just said, okay, there's a storm coming. It started blowing and snowing. So, okay, let's try to stick together. And we leave at 3:30 in the morning. So 3:30 in the morning, we had all the dogs booted up and fed and ready to go. But, you know, it was snowing. So we just looked at each other and I was like, are we sure? That, I don't know. Should we just go in and check? We went in and we checked with the race judge and the checkpoint manager over there. And we were checking the GPS tracker, and the speeds on the way to Elim, they were so slow. I'm like, okay, maybe we'll wait for some reports. And Monica Zappa had just gotten to the checkpoint. So we managed to get a hold of her and talk with her. And we're like, okay, we want to go. And she told us, well, guys, I wouldn't. There's like 4 feet high snowdrift and it's blowing and it's foggy. I couldn't see anything. I couldn't see the trail marker. So she's like, if I were you, I would just wait. And actually got a little bit scary because it's like, okay, if we're going to fall too far behind, if we have to wait for 2 days for the storm to be over, we're going to be out of the race. You know, we're going to be kicked out because we're too far behind. But then we talked with Mark Norman, race marshal, and he actually gave us a very nice idea. The trail sweeps were the snow machines to follow the race and make sure that all the last mushers are in safe. They were behind us, so I was like, okay, they're going to catch up with you, and they can be in front of you and at least break the trail and kick down those snowdrifts. And that's actually what happened, and it was actually a very good idea because the conditions between Koyak and Elim, they were bad. I mean, I'm talking you could not see more than one or sometimes two trail markers ahead of you. It was just a snow. One of those coastal snowstorms that I've heard about for years, and I really don't want to be finding myself into, but you know, I was just in the middle. And once again, you trust your leaders, you let them go, and that's how you do it. There's no stopping, there's no turning around, there's only one way, you know, unless it gets very bad and you need to stop, you just have to go. And that's what we did. And we got to Elim, and all of a sudden, everybody is there. And I was like, okay, hasn't anyone moved? And I was like, no, nobody has moved for the past 24 hours. I was like, okay, oh, that's surprising. And that's where the big story of the Elim 11 started, where six mushers were already in Elim, and we, the Koyak 5, joined them. So we became the Elim 11 all of a sudden. And again, same situation. The sea ice, you know, was covered with water, and there was no trail. And we started to get the news that three mushers were rescued by helicopter in front of us. So that's what we were going into. Again, we were very lucky. Martin Boozer was with us. He has done 36 Iditarods. This was his 37th, and he never scratched, and he won 4.
And that's so amazing.
That's amazing. So for a bunch of rookies and young mushers that everybody else was, it was very nice to have him. I mean, at least for myself, you know. I knew that if I was doing what he was doing, that would have probably been a good choice, you know. So, again, the same thing. He said, if we have a chance, we all stick together and we're all in this together and we just take care of each other and we just have to make it through. So two local guides were hired to break trail on the old mail trail that goes overland and not down on the water. And so we settled to leave for 8 o'clock in the morning. And 8 o'clock, everybody left, but 3-4 miles out, I mean, I was maybe seventh or eighth in the line of the 11, and we were just stopping, and I couldn't see anything that was going on in front of me. So basically what happened is that the trail breakers, the local trail breakers, were in front trying to break trails, and behind them we had the trail sweeps. And but the trail sweeps had already lost the trail from the trail breakers in front of me. I'm talking about 5-10 minutes behind, not even that. The trail just gets blown over, especially if it's not marked as it was, because nobody had been there for the whole year. So we were just there, and there was not anything you could do. The trail sweeps, they tried to go around looking for tracks of the true trail breakers, but they were gone. So we had no other choice than turning around. And that's, again, when I saw Martin Boozer turning around, and I said, okay, if he's running a team of young dogs, just like I am doing, and if he's turning around and he's not afraid of screwing them up, that's the best choice. So let's all turn around. We went back, and it was a great mood, actually. You know, everybody was, we're all in that together, and it was a very good bunch of people. So it was a nice feeling. And there was nobody freaking out. Nobody was grumpy. Nobody was, you know, pouting. Everybody was, we just wanted to go through and just make the best. And then we had a nice conference call with Mark Norman, the race judge, race marshal, and race director. And we all decided to try again at 5 o'clock in the morning the next day. And that's what we did. So same thing, same plan, trail breakers and trail sweeps in front of us, trying to establish the trail. And that's what we did. And boy, in a couple of times, you know, it was just a couple of minutes behind the marshal in front of me, and I just could not see the trail. And a couple of times I thought, I was never afraid for my own life. You know, I knew I could have always turned around and go back to the checkpoint, but a couple of times I was like, if I'm lost here, I'm going to have to push the button and be rescued, or I know where I am. I don't want to be lost. I need to wade this storm through. It was stormy. I mean, we couldn't see any trail, any trace of the trail. We could maybe, sometimes you could pick up a headlamp on something in front of you that was just turning around from the top of the hill. So you could kind of guess. And then you need, again, very good leaders, try to jihad, turning right and left and look for some tracks and try to make it towards where you see that headlamp over there. And that's what we did. You know, we just kept waiting, and okay, all of us, then we can go a little more, a little more, a little more. And that's how we did it. And it worked out just fine. And but it sure was an interesting experience.
After enduring the conditions with the rest of the Elam 11, Fabio eventually made his way past the final checkpoints and toward the finish line in Nome. Rookie mushers who compete in the Iditarod receive the official finisher's belt buckle to mark their accomplishment. This belt buckle is prestigious in the mushing world, and it means a lot to those who receive one. Fabio explains his emotions as he approached the finish line of his first Iditarod.
Well, yeah, that's what you make, you do everything for the $20,000 belt buckle. That's what it's called. But you know, the funny thing is that I, of course I knew I was getting close to Nome, but you know, it's not that from White Mountain to Nome is all easy. You have to go through the Topkak Hills, which is a lot of up and downs, a lot of climbing still. And once again, we were in a whiteout and in a snowstorm all the way to the end. So it's not that it was just an enjoyable ride all the way to the finish line. You know, that storm never left us alone. So you climb up Cape Nome, and what I've heard from all the mushers is that one of the most amazing feelings, you get up from the top and you start seeing the light of Nome, and you know it's there, you know you have made it. But not this year. I didn't realize I was in Nome until the last couple of miles, when I started seeing some houses around. It's like, okay, I guess I'm getting close. I could not see any of those lights. I did not have that nice feeling of, oh, I'm done with that. I was still trying to look for trail markers and looking for a trail all the way to the end. But I do remember when I was maybe 1 mile away, I looked up and I saw the bird arch over there, and I actually tried not to look at it. I was like, okay, I'm not gonna cry. I don't wanna see that. I'll just try not to look at it. And another very exciting moment is, I don't know if you know, but when a musher is approaching the finish line, there's a big siren going on in Nome, so people get out of the hazard and come to the finish line. And when I heard the siren for me, I was maybe a few minutes away, that actually gave me goosebumps. That's the moment when I realized that, oh my God, that's a siren for me. You know, I've heard it for so many marchers in the past, and now it's really me. And I got there, and my best friend and handler, Kaylin, was there, and we just gave it a big hug, and it felt nice to be there, I can tell you. You know, it was exhausting, and it was challenging, and again, that was everything I've done for the past 2 years. All the money I've spent, all the energies I've put, all the things I had to go through, it all comes down to that one moment. And again, Nome was kind of a ghost town then because of the COVID, not so many people around, but who cares, you know? I got my belt buckle, and that was the most amazing feeling ever. I mean, just a feeling of relief and accomplishment that you get when you go through under that arch, it's just amazing. It's something that I've been basically daydreaming about for years, and I'm not kidding. Most of the times that I was out training dogs, I could just picture myself crossing that arch, you know, and getting there, it was quite emotional and quite an accomplishment, I can tell you.
Highland Canine Training offers affordable and proven dog training solutions to resolve even the most difficult of dog problems. Founded in 2006, Highland Canine Training also offers quality working dogs to meet the increasingly demanding requirements of today's military and law enforcement agencies. In addition, they offer first-class canine education programs at their school for dog trainers. So far, they've hosted students from over 30 different countries. The School for Dog Trainers offers affordable financing and accepts GI Bill and VA benefits. The Service Dog Training Division at Highland Canine Training develops and trains some of the best service dogs in the industry and offers worldwide delivery. Their commitment to customer service and support continues to set them apart from the competition and makes them a leader in the industry. Visit HighlandK9.com or call 866-200-2207 to learn more and see the difference. Royal Canin delivers precise nutritional solutions so your dog can perform at their very best level. The individual health of every dog is as unique as they are. However, these health needs are often characteristic of their size, breed, or lifestyle. Each individual recipe is formulated to deliver the exact level of natural antioxidants, vitamins, fiber, prebiotics, and minerals that are essential to your pet's unique health needs. Discover how Royal Canin products can help every pet enjoy its best health possible. To achieve a perfect balance of nutrients for each dog, they rely on an extensive network of canine experts across the globe, including veterinarians, universities, dog professionals, and their own research and development center in France. Royal Canin helps your dogs train and perform at their full potential. To learn more about Royal Canin, visit them on the web at royalcanin.com.
With his first Iditarod under his finisher's belt buckle, and with the stress the race had caused fading into a distant memory, Fabio has had time to reflect on favorite experiences from the race. We ask him to reflect on his most memorable moment from his maiden Iditarod voyage.
Ooh, I think I was telling you before, the run between Rainy Pass and Rhone, with all going in that headwind windstorm, with a full moon, you could see the whole Alaska range, all the mountains around you, you know, in the winter. It was not snowing, it was a ground storm. So it was just a mess, but you could see all the mountains around it and the dogs were on fire. That has absolutely been one of the highlights of my life. I'll never forget how thrilling and exciting that moment was. Again, it was borderline too scary because the conditions were absolutely tough. And it was not easy, and it was a borderline situation. But again, going through it and see how my dogs were doing and all that around me, it was just thrilling. It's absolutely one of the highlights of my life.
Awesome. So we mentioned COVID. At what point, you know, it had a pretty big effect on the race this year. Where were you? Do you remember where you were when you heard that it was going to have some impact on the race?
Well, on the Thursday before the race, there's the marshals meeting, and the race marshal, they gave us a paper and just said that they made sure that the villages knew that we were taking this seriously and we were going to follow some of those, you know, basic guidelines. And we knew that some of the villages were quite concerned about having all these people getting into their checkpoints and their villages. But I think that in probably Galena, that's where we started to know that the checkpoints of Shaktulik was not going to be there, basically, due to the storm. And also Nulado, they didn't want us there. So I think it was even before Galena. I can't exactly remember. But Galena, for sure, I remember all the papers hanging around, making sure that everybody knew that they did not know exactly how the checkpoints would look. But what happens was absolutely amazing, especially in the checkpoint of Shaktulik. We could not get into the village. So some of the villagers, they just took everything in their hands and they went to old Shaktulik, which is a couple of miles before. They took an old building, like probably nobody's been living there for 50 years or something. There were 4 feet of snow inside and all the snow outside. They brought a tractor there. They plowed all the snow. They brought all the drawbacks there. They shoveled 4 feet of snow from all inside the building. They covered the windows. They put some plastic up to cover the windows. They hauled a stove there, and we got there. And we even had a portable toilet, and we had a microwave in that checkpoint. So that's how amazing and dedicated all the people around they did is. You know, these people from the village, you know, they were concerned about the COVID, but you know, they were just amazing. You know, what they have done is absolutely impressive.
We had an opportunity while we were up to go and do some motion prior to ceremonial start. And I'd had an opportunity to do a little bit of motion in Alaska in the summertime, as you sort of described on the golf carts and the dogs are pulling through the mountains, not on snow. But this time when we came up, it was my first experience actually on the snow. And we were out at Martin's place. It is a very, and I've been around dogs all my life, but it truly is a very difficult thing to articulate to people what that experience is like to have that crew of dogs out in front of you and taking in the scenery of Alaska and just all the things that go along with it. And I guess I was just wondering, you've got a lot more experience with it, if you could take an opportunity to take a shot at sort of describing that and painting that picture for people so that they can understand it.
Well, you know, driving a dog team is basically the most addictive thing you could ever do. You know, once you get on the sled the first time, you know, unless you are some kind of monsters who I actually do not want to know, you know, the feeling that you get, you know, just seeing the enthusiasm, you feel the enthusiasm of the dogs. It just gets to you in such a deep level. And you're just basically, the first time, you're maybe just a monkey standing there. But, you know, being in Alaska and looking around you and seeing what these dogs are doing, it's just a mind-blowing experience. You know, I've been working with tourists for 7 years, and you have no idea the amount of people who actually just, you take off with the dogs, you pull that hook, and people start crying, you know. And it's so much in everybody's, you know, mind. You know, they've been seeing movies for years, for decades, and all of a sudden they find themselves in Lapland or in Alaska, wherever it is, and they're driving a dog team. You know, if you think about it, it's something that you just see in Jack London's books and movies, and it's absolutely amazing. And again, you know, the best part of it is what you get from the dogs. You know, people do not understand until they are on a sled, they do not understand the amount of energy and the amount of enthusiasm that the dogs have. You know, they cannot understand why we're standing on the brake and that we have to stand on the brake the whole time. Those dogs just want to go. They do not care about anything. As long as they have a trail in front of them and something to pull up behind them, their life is perfect. And you are part of that, you know, and they do feel your emotions. So if you're happy, they are actually even more happy and they're pulling even harder. And it's such a great exchange of good vibes that I haven't found in anything else in my life yet.
As we've explored throughout our series of podcast episodes, the Iditarod faces several existential threats, most prominently the constant attacks from animal rights activists. There are other difficulties, given that mushing is a huge investment of time and money to go racing, and is also competing with other sports for popularity and attention. To finish up, we asked Fabio how people could get involved in the sport of mushing if they're interested.
Well, you know, there actually is a decline in the attention to the sport, and also in the, just look at the numbers, you know, this year only 57 mushers signed up for a litter, and last year was 52. You know, 3-4 years ago, we're talking about more than 80. So again, the economical crisis also has an impact on that, because it costs a lot of money, so not so many mushers have the money to do it every year anymore. But apart from that, there's also some stupid, you know, animal rights activists who are trying to shut down the sport, but I'm not even going to talk about it because they do not even need any mention, because they are just stupid. So you do not talk about stupid, just let it go. But what I can tell to the normal people anywhere is, if you have any chance, go out, go to a kennel, if it's in the summer or in the winter, go out and meet the dogs, you know, go see with your own eyes. And again, it's such an amazing, you see it in their eyes, you know, once you get into a kennel, you see their enthusiasm. And if you step on a sled or on a cart or anything, just play with the puppies, you know, you will get to experience not even 1% of what we can do on the trail with them, but it will be so absolutely amazing and exciting. But watch out, because it's addictive. As I was telling you, I was planning 3-4 months. Oh, I like dogs. Let's go cuddle with the dogs and try it. And it's been 9 years, and here I am still. And it's absolutely addictive. So go visit a kennel if you have the chance. Go talk to a musher. Again, if you talk to a musher, you have no idea how many incredible stories you can get. If you ask a musher why he's doing this, why he runs dogs, you will get so many interesting and absolutely amazing stories and motivation. It will be absolutely inspiring.
Yeah, it does seem like a huge family, from the vets to the mushers to the handlers to the villagers to all the people that make this. I mean, the people who move the ropes at the ceremonial start to let folks cross the street. I mean, all those people volunteering their time. And it seems like they all have one single thing in common, and that is an absolute love for dogs.
Absolutely. That's what it is all about. You know, it's all about the dogs, you know. And it's all about being part of this amazing thing. I mean, if you think about this, the history of the editor and what editor means for Alaska and for the whole world, just the image of the editor, what this is, it makes people proud. And everybody that just volunteers, they come on, there's people that come every year on their own money, they fly all the way, and they just to help out and just to be a little part of this amazing event. And what I have been noticing this year, I knew it before, and this year I just saw it even more, is that Iditarod brings out the best of people. You know, as you were saying, everybody is involved, you know, the race marshals, the veterinarians, the mushers, the dogs, all the volunteers, you know, everybody is giving 100%. You know, it's absolutely. And it's all about the dogs, you know. Everybody sees the dogs. Like, the best thing in the world is how much happiness you see on the ceremonial start on the first day. The dogs are going through, usually there's maybe 30,000-35,000 people, and every single person is smiling. Everybody sees a dog team coming, and everybody's just excited, you know, and you just see those long tongues sticking out and those, you know, excited eyes. It's amazing how much joy dogs can bring and what dogs can bring out in people. You know, they lead by example, and that's why people give so much for a litter. You know, look at what those dogs are doing. They're running 1,000 miles and they're not even looking back once. So people just have to keep up with them.
And with those words from Fabio, our series of podcasts on the Iditarod and season 2 of A Life of Dogs comes to a close. It was an amazing experience for our crew to head out to Alaska. And we are so grateful to everyone who gave up their time to speak with us for these episodes. Learning about the connection that the Iditarod has with the state of Alaska and how the world of mushing has evolved to be one big family, comprising the mushers themselves, the veterinarian specialists, the organizers, and even the local residents at these checkpoints, has been so informative for us, and we hope it has been informative for you too. Here at A Life of Dogs, we're looking forward to bringing you a range of new stories on Man's Best Friend. In the coming months, we'll be releasing more information about our plans for Season 3. And if you have an interesting dog story you'd like for us to feature, be sure to reach out to us on social media or by emailing us. Thanks for joining us for Season 2. If you haven't listened to all our episodes, be sure to. Also, if you haven't checked out Season 1, be sure to do that as well. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Look forward to seeing you in Season 3.